Well, hello, and welcome to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm Cory Doctorow, and reading to you from the penultimate installment of my long-running reading of Bruce Sterling's wonderful book, The Hacker Crackdown, A History of the Early Days of the Civil Liberties Movement on the Internet. As I say, it's the penultimate installment. I have about two readings left for you, and then it will all be done, and not a moment too soon, because in 3 weeks, I'm going to be a dad. If our daughter has the good sense to turn up on time, she might be a little late, she might be a little early. I'm told 85% of women in Britain deliver in the 41st week, which suggests that that is the human gestation period and not 40 weeks as previously reported. However, I guess the doctors know something I don't and persist in insisting that 40 weeks is normal. We are round and have waxed to great girth in preparation for the delivery of the tiny wee infant. She has a name, Poesy Emmeline Fibonacci Nautilus Taylor Doctorow. That's the name for now, unless she comes out and looks at us and we look at her and we decide, you know, you're much more of a Gertie. But I think that she's going to be a Posy, Poesy. The only other news from the week, I have finished a new story, I think I mentioned this last week, called The Things That Make Me Weak and Strange Get Engineered Away. The lyric, of course, comes from, the title rather, comes from a Jonathan Coulton lyric from his song The Future. The story is for a new and secret market, and when it comes out, I will be podcasting it for you. That said, I'm not exactly sure what my podcast plans are for after the baby comes. I might just take some time off. I feel like I've read pretty much all the fiction for you. Although a reading of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town is kind of an interesting notion. It would take quite a while, though. The trick is, I want to be done with it by May. Maybe that would work. I want to be done with it by May because I want to read Little Brother, my next novel, when I go on tour with it. I want to read it through several months. And, interesting. Yeah, maybe it will squeeze in. Anyway, we'll see how it goes. I might just decide that fatherhood is more fun than podcasting. We'll see. In any event, without further ado, here is the penultimate installment of Bruce Sterling's The Hacker Crackdown. My book on The Hacker Crackdown is almost over now. I have deliberately saved the best for last. In February 1991, I attended the CPSR Public Policy Roundtable in Washington, D.C. CPSR, the Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility, was a sister organization of EFF, or perhaps its aunt, being older and somewhat wiser in the ways of the world of politics. Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility began in 1981 in Palo Alto as an informal discussion group of Californian computer scientists and technicians, united by nothing more than an electronic mailing list. This typical high-tech adhocracy received the dignity of its own acronym in 1982 and was formally incorporated in 1983. CPSR lobbied government and public alike with an educational outreach effort, sternly warning against any foolish and unthinking trust in complex computer systems. CPSR insisted that mere computers should never be considered a magic panacea for humanity's social, ethical, or political problems. CPSR members were especially troubled about the safety, stability, and dependability of the military computer systems, and very especially troubled by those systems controlling nuclear arsenals. CPSR was best known for its persistent and well-publicized attacks on the scientific credibility of the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. In 1990, CPSR was the nation's veteran cyber-political activist group, with over 2,000 members in 21 local chapters across the U.S. It was especially active in Boston, Silicon Valley, and Washington, D.C., where its Washington office sponsored the Public Policy Roundtable. The roundtable, however, had been funded by EFF, which had passed CPSR an extensive grant for operations. This was the first large-scale official meeting of what was to become the Electronic Civil Libertarian Community. 60 people attended, myself included. In this instance, not so much as a journalist as a cyberpunk author. Many of the luminaries of the field took part. Kapoor and Godwin, as a matter of course, Richard Seville and Mark Rotenberg of CPSR, Jerry Berman of the ACLU, John Quarterman, author of The Matrix. Stephen Levy, author of Hackers. George Perry and Sandy Weiss of Prodigy Services, there at a network about the civil liberties troubles their young commercial network was experiencing. Dr. Dorothy Denning, Cliff Figolo, manager of The Well, Steve Jackson was there, having finally found his ideal target audience, and so was Craig Nydorf, Night Lightning himself, with his attorney, Sheldon Zenner. Katie Hafner, science journalist and co-author of Cyberpunk, Outlaws and Hackers on the Computer Frontier, Dave Farber, ARPANET pioneer and fabled internet guru, Jan Laurie Goldman of the ACLU's Project on Privacy and Technology, John Nagel of Autodesk and The Well, Don Goldberg of the House Judiciary Committee, Tom Guido Boni, the defense attorney in the Internet Worm case, Lance Hoffman, computer science professor at the George Washington University, Ellie Noam of Columbia, and a host of others no less distinguished. Senator Patrick Leahy delivered the keynote address, expressing his determination to keep ahead of the curve of the issue of electronic free speech. The address was well received, and the sense of excitement was palpable. Every panel discussion was interesting. Some were entirely compelling. People networked with an almost frantic interest. I myself had a most interesting and cordial lunch discussion with Noel and Jean Gaylor, Admiral Gaylor being a former director of the National Security Agency. As this was the first known encounter between an actual no-kidding cyberpunk and a chief executive of America's largest and best-financed electronic espionage apparat, there was naturally a bit of eyebrow-raising on both sides. Unfortunately, our discussion was off the record. In fact, all discussions at the CPSR were officially off the record, the idea being to do some serious networking in an atmosphere of complete frankness, rather than to stage a media circus. In any case, CPSR Roundtable, though interesting and intensely valuable, was as nothing compared to the truly mind-boggling event that transpired a mere month later. Computers, Freedom, and Privacy. 400 people from every conceivable corner of America's electronic community. As a science fiction writer, I have been to some weird gigs in my day, but this thing is truly beyond the pale. Even Cyberthon, Point Foundation's Woodstock of cyberspace, where Bay Area psychedelia collided headlong with the emergent world of computerized virtual reality, was like a Kiwanis Club gig compared to this astonishing do. The electronic community had reached an apogee. Almost every principle in this book is in attendance. Civil libertarians, computer cops, the digital underground, even a few discreet telco people. Color-coded dots for lapel tags are distributed. Free expression issues, law enforcement, computer security, privacy, journalists, lawyers, educators, librarians, programmers. Stylish punk black dots for the hackers and phone freaks. Almost everyone here seems to wear 8 or 9 dots, and to have 6 or 7 professional hats. It is a community. Something like Lebanon, perhaps, but a digital nation. People who had feuded all year in the national press, people who had entertained the deepest suspicions of one another's motives and ethics, are now in each other's laps. Computers, freedom, and privacy had every reason in the world to turn ugly, and yet, except for small interruptions of puzzling nonsense from the convention's token lunatic, a surprising bonhomie reigned. CFP was like a wedding party in which two lovers, unstable bride and charlatan groom, tie the knot in a clearly disastrous matrimony. It is clear to both families, even to neighbors and random guests, that this is not a workable relationship, and yet the young couple's desperate attraction can brook no further delay. They simply cannot help themselves. Crockery will fly, shrieks from their newlywed home will wake the city block. Divorce waits in the wing like a vulture over the Kalahari, and yet this is a wedding, and there is going to be a child from it. Tragedies end in death, comedies in marriage. The hacker crackdown is ending in marriage, and there will be a child. From the beginning, anomalies reign. John Perry Barlow, Cyberspace Ranger, is here. His color photo in the New York Times Magazine, Barlow scowling in a grim Wyoming skyscape with long black coat, dark hat, a Macintosh SE-30 propped on a fence post, and an awesome Frontier rifle tucked under one arm will be the single most striking visual image of the hacker crackdown. And he is CFP's guest of honor, along with Gail Thackeray of the FCIC. What on earth do they expect these dual guests to do with each other? Waltz? Barlow delivers the first address. Uncharacteristically, he is hoarse. The sheer volume of roadwork has worn him down. He speaks briefly, congenially, in a plea for conciliation, and takes his leave to a storm of applause. Then Gail Thackeray takes the stage. She's visibly nervous. She's been on the well a lot lately, reading those Barlow posts. Following Barlow is a challenge to anyone. In honor of the famous lyricist for the Grateful Dead, she announces readily, she is going to read a poem. A poem she has composed herself. It's an awful poem, doggerel in the rollicking meter of Robert W. Service's The Cremation of Sam McGee, but it is, in fact, a poem. It's the Ballad of the Electronic Frontier, a poem about the hacker crackdown and the sheer unlikelihood of CFP. It's full of in-jokes. The score or so cops in the audience, who are sitting together in a nervous clack, are absolutely cracking up. Gail's poem is the funniest goddamn thing they've ever heard. The hackers and civlibs, who had this woman figured for Ilsa, she-wolf of the SS, are staring with their jaws hanging loosely. Never in the wildest reaches of their imagination had they figured Gail Thackeray was capable of such a totally off-the-wall move. You can see them punching their mental control reset buttons. Jesus, this woman's a hacker weirdo. She's just like us. God, this changes everything. Al Bays, computer technician for the FBI, had been the only top cop at the CPSR roundtable, dragged there with his arm bent by Dorothy Denning. He was guarded and tight-lipped at CPSR Roundtable, a lion thrown to the Christians. At CFP, backed by a clack of cops, Bays suddenly waxes eloquent and even droll, describing the FBI's NCIC 2000, a gigantic digital catalog of criminal records, as if he has suddenly become some weird hybrid of George Orwell and George Gobel. Tentatively, he makes an arcane joke about statistical analysis. At least a third of the crowd laughs aloud. They didn't laugh at that in my last speech, Bays observes. He had been addressing cops. Straight cops, not computer people. It had been a worthy meeting, useful one supposes, but nothing like this. There has never been anything like this. Without any prodding, without any preparation, people in the audience simply begin to ask questions. Long hairs, freaky people, mathematicians. Bays is answering, politely, frankly, fully, like a man walking on air. The ballroom's atmosphere crackles with surreality. A female lawyer behind me breaks into a sweat, and a hot waft of surprisingly potent and musky perfume flows off her pulse points. People are giddy with laughter. People are interested, fascinated, their eyes so wide and dark they seem eroticized. Unlikely daisy chains form in the halls, around the bar, on the escalators. Cops with hackers, civil rights with FBI, Secret Service with phone freaks. Gail Thackeray is at her crispest, in a white wool sweater with a tiny Secret Service logo. I found fiber optic at the payphones, and when he saw my sweater, he turned into a pillar of salt, she chortles. Fiber discusses his case at much length with his arresting officer, Don Delaney of the New York State Police. After an hour's chat, the two of them look ready to begin singing Auld Lang Syne. Fiber finally finds the courage to get his worst complaint off his chest. It wasn't so much the arrest. It was the charge. Pirating service off 900 numbers? I'm a programmer, Fiber insists. This lame charge is going to hurt my rep. It would have been cool to be busted for something happening, like Section 1030 computer intrusion, maybe some kind of crime that's scarcely been invented yet. Not lousy phone fraud. Phooey. Delaney seems regretful. He had a mountain of possible charges against Fiber Optic. The kid's gonna plead guilty anyway. He's a first-timer. They always plead. Could have charged the kid with almost anything and gotten the same result in the end. Delaney seems genuinely sorry not to have gratified Fiber in this harmless fashion. Too late now. Fiber's pled already. All water under the bridge. What are you gonna do? Delaney's got a good grasp on the hacker mentality. He held a press conference after he busted the Masters of Deception kid. Some journo had asked him, "Would you describe these people as geniuses?" Delaney's deadpan answer, "Perfect. No, I would describe these people as defendants." Delaney busts a kid for hacking codes with repeated random dialing, tells the press that 9X can track this stuff in no time flat nowadays, and a kid has to be stupid to do something so easy to catch. Dead on again. Hackers don't mind being thought of as Genghis Khan by the Straits, but if there's anything that gets them where they live, it's being called dumb. Wouldn't be as much fun for Fiber next time around. As a second offender, he's going to see prison. Hackers break the law. They're not geniuses either. They're going to be defendants. And yet, Delaney muses over a drink in the hotel bar, he's found it impossible to treat them as common criminals. Delaney knows criminals. These kids, by comparison, are clueless. There's just no crook vibe off of them. They don't smell right. They're just not bad. Delaney has seen a lot of action. He did Vietnam. He's been shot at. He has shot people. He's a homicide cop from New York. He has the appearance of a man who has not only seen the shit hit the fan, but has seen it splattered across whole city blocks and left to ferment for years. This guy's been around. He listens to Steve Jackson tell his story. The dreamy game strategist has been dealt a bad hand. He has played it for all he is worth. Under his nerdish SF fan exterior is a core of iron. People say Steve Jackson believes in the rules, believes in fair play. He will never compromise his principles, never give up. Steve, Delaney says to Steve Jackson, they had some balls whoever busted you. You're all right. Jackson, stunned, falls silent and actually blushes with pleasure. Nydorf has grown up a lot in the past year. The kid is a quick study, you gotta give him that. Dressed by his mom, the fashion manager for a national clothing chain, Missouri College techie frat Craig Nydorf out-dappers everyone at this gig but the toniest East Coast lawyers. The iron jaws of prison clang shut without him, and now law school beckons for Nydorf. He looks like a larval congressman. Not a hacker, our Mr. Nydorf. He's not interested in computer science. Why should he be? He's not interested in writing C code the rest of his life, and besides, he's seen where the chips fall. To the world of computer science, he and Frack were just a curiosity. But to the world of law, the kid has learned where the bodies are buried. He carries his notebook of press clippings wherever he goes. Fiber Optic makes fun of Nydorf for a Midwestern geek, believing that Acid Freak does acid and listens to acid rock. Hell no! Acid's never done acid. Acid's into acid house music. Jesus, the very idea of doing LSD. Our parents did LSD, you clown. Thackeray suddenly turns upon Craig Nydorf the full lighthouse glare of her attention and begins a determined half-hour attempt to win the boy over. The Joan Arc of computer crime is giving career advice to Night Lightning. Your experience will be very valuable, a real asset, she tells him, with unmistakable 60,000-watt sincerity. Nydorf is fascinated. He listens with unfeigned attention. He's nodding and saying, yes, ma'am. Yes, Craig, you too can forget all about money and enter the glamorous and horribly underpaid world of prosecuting computer crime. You can put your former friends in prison. Oops. You cannot go on dueling at modem's length indefinitely. You cannot beat one another senseless with rolled-up press clippings. Sooner or later, you have to come directly to grips. And yet, the very act of assembling here has changed the entire situation drastically. John Quartermain, author of The Matrix, explains the internet at his symposium. It is the largest news network in the world. It is growing by leaps and bounds, and yet you cannot measure internet because you cannot stop it in place. It cannot stop because there is no one anywhere in the world with the authority to stop internet. It changes, yes, it grows. It embeds itself across the post-industrial, post-modern world, and it generates community wherever it touches, and it is doing this all by itself. Fiber is different. A very fin de siècle kid, Fiber Optic. Barlow says he looks like an Edwardian dandy. He does, rather. Shaven neck, the sides of his skull cropped hip-hop close, unruly tangle of black hair on top that looks pomaded. He stays up till 4 a.m. and misses all the sessions, then hangs out in payphone booths with his acoustic coupler gutsily cracking systems right in the middle of the heaviest law enforcement dudes in the U.S., or at least pretending to, unlike Frank Drake. Drake, who wrote Dorothy Denning out of nowhere and asked for an interview for his cheapo cyberpunk fanzine and then started grilling her on her ethics. She was squirming, too. Drake, scarecrow tall with his floppy blonde mohawk, rotting tennis shoes, and black leather jacket lettered Illuminati in red, gives off an unmistakable air of the bohemian literatus. Drake is the kind of guy who reads British industrial magazines and appreciates William Gibson because the quality of the prose is so tasty. Drake could never touch a phone or a keyboard again, and he'd still have the nose ring and the blurry photocopied fanzines and the sampled industrial music. He's a radical punk with a desktop publishing rig and an internet address. Standing next to Drake, the diminutive fiber looks like he's been physically coagulated out of phone lines, born to freak. Dorothy Denning approaches Fiber suddenly. The two of them are about the same height and body build. Denning's blue eyes flash behind the round window frames of her glasses. "Why did you say I was quaint?" she asks Fiber, quaintly. It's a perfect description, but Fiber is nonplussed. "Well, I... "I also think you're quaint, Dorothy," I say, novelist to the rescue, the journalist gift of gab. She is neat and dapper, and yet there's an arcane quality to her, something like a pilgrim maiden behind leaded glass. If she were 6 inches high, Dorothy Denning would look great inside a china cabinet. The cryptographics, whatever. Weirdly, Peter Denning looks just like his wife. You could pick this gentleman out of a thousand guys as the soulmate of Dorothy Denning. Wearing tailored slacks, a spotless fuzzy varsity sweater, and a neatly knotted academician's tie, this fine-boned, exquisitely pale, utterly civilized, and hyper-intelligent couple seem to have emerged from some cleaner and finer parallel universe where humanity exists to do the brain teaser's column in Scientific American. Why does this nice lady hang out with these unsavory characters? Because the time has come for it. That's why. Because she's the best there is at what she does. Don Parker is here, the great bald eagle of computer crime. With his bald dome, great height, and enormous Lincoln-like hands, the great visionary pioneer of the field plows through the lesser mortals like an icebreaker. His eyes are fixed on the future with the rigidity of a bronze statue. Eventually, he tells his audience, all business crime will be computer crime because businesses will do everything through computers. Computer crime, as a category, will vanish. In the meantime, passing fads will flourish and fail and evaporate. Parker's commanding, resonant voice is sphinx-like. Everything is viewed from some eldritch valley of deep historical abstraction. Yes, they've come and they've gone, these passing flaps in the world of digital computation. The radio frequency emanation scandal. KGB and MI5 and CIA do it every day. It's easy, but nobody else ever has. The salami slice fraud, mostly mythical. Crimoids, he calls them. Computer viruses are the current crimoid champ, a lot less dangerous than most people let on, but the novelty is fading and there's a great crimoid vacuum at the moment. The press is visibly hungering for something more outrageous. The great man shares with us a few speculations on the coming crimoids. Desktop forgery. Wow. Computers stolen just for the sake of the information within them. Data napping. Happened in Britain a while ago. Could be a coming thing. Phantom nodes in the internet. Parker handles his overhead projector sheets with an ecclesiastical air. He wears a gray double-breasted suit, a light blue shirt, and a very quiet tie of understated maroon and blue paisley. Aphorisms emerge from him with slow, leaden emphasis. There is no such thing as an adequately secure computer when one faces a sufficiently powerful adversary. Deterrence is the most socially useful aspect of security. People are the primary weakness in all information systems. The entire baseline of computer security must be shifted upwards. Don't ever violate your computer security by describing publicly your security measures. People in the audience are beginning to squirm, and yet there is something about the elemental purity of this guy's philosophy that compels an uneasy respect. Parker sounds like the only sane guy left in the lifeboat sometimes, the guy who can prove rigorously, from deep moral principles, that Harvey here, the one with the broken leg and the checkered pass, is the one who has to be, that is, Mr. Harvey is best placed to make the necessary sacrifice for the security, and indeed the very survival of the rest of the lifeboat's crew. Computer security, Parker informs us mournfully, is a nasty topic, and we wish we didn't have to have it. The security expert, armed with method and logic, must think, imagine, everything that the adversary might do before the adversary might actually do it. It is as if the criminal's dark brain were an extensive subprogram within the shining cranium of Don Parker. He is a Holmes whose Moriarty does not yet quite exist, and so must be perfectly simulated. CFP is a stellar gathering, with the giddiness of a wedding. It is a happy time, a happy ending. They know their world is changing forever tonight, and they're proud to have been here to see it happen, to talk, to drink, to help. And yet, as night falls, a certain elegiac quality manifests itself as the crowd gathers beneath the chandeliers with their wine glasses and dessert plates. Something is ending here, gone forever, and it takes a while to pinpoint it. It is the end of the amateurs.